Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where a single man possessing a good fortune must be in want of a wife. My name is Caroline, and what a superbly featured room, and what excellent boiled potatoes. And she has bewitched me body and soul. I love her. It's Imogen Westnight.
Very nice, very nice.
Practice that on the train.
Very good. Yeah, no, I mean, those lines are seared into my brain. So.
I love you.
And I never wish to be parted from you from this day on.
Bewitched me body and soul. So this is what many people refer to as the other Pride and Prejudice.
Yes.
This was adapted in 2005 by Joe Wright, his first directorial debut, starring Keira Knightley, which immediately was controversial because there was a time in the early noughties where, and actually throughout the noughties, where we decided that Keira Knightley, a nice woman with a good face.
We hated that about her. No. Get out of here. And also young and nice.
Yeah. Too nice. Something sounds fishy. Let's drive her mad.
Yes, I don't really know what she's up to now. I think she mostly does period dramas.
Yeah, that's her vibe.
I respect her for dropping out of life a little bit. She probably had a bit too much life.
In many ways, she is the English Anne Hathaway.
She is the English Anne Hathaway. That is a good point.
Someone who arrived on the scene very young, too attractive, and very good at their
and
job.
And had to be punished for it.
And also seemed very invested in doing a good job about stories they found important.
Yeah, I think she's a good actor. I'm a huge Keira Knightley apologist. I know she's got that slightly weird thing with her mouth, but don't we all have a slightly weird thing with our mouths? Do you know what I mean?
And also, isn't that why we love actors? Is because they deliver idiosyncrasies to roles that wouldn't be there otherwise?
Exactly.
Like Meryl Streep has that thing where she always touches her mouth, and if you
She does.
Yeah. Oh, she loves to play characters who are flustered, then they just sort of tap at their mouth a bit.
Yes.
But anyway, this is your favourite version.
Yes, this is my favourite version, and I even feel nervous saying it out loud because for years I've felt kind of ashamed of that because I know the true close version is the 1995 BBC one. Mm-hmm. That's more like a beat for beat adaptation of the book. The book is good. No argument there, but I just prefer this one. If I'm going to sit down and watch one, it's going to be this one.
Well, yeah, obviously, if you don't have an entire day to dedicate to the Pride and Prejudice,
no, well, that's part of it. And I often have 2 hours and 6 minutes to just like put this on and enjoy it. And even in a kind of background, I don't really need to focus anymore because I know so well what's going to happen. It's just so soothing to me. I don't even know when I started doing that, just watching it all of the time because it wasn't when it came out.
Yeah.
I don't think I really cared about Pride and Prejudice. I mean, I definitely didn't. I had to study the book at school and was quite like...
Oh, did you?
Okay. Yeah. I think it was, I don't know, maybe it was just one of those things where you're like, you're too young to be studying. Mm-hmm. I think I was like 12 or 13 and they were being like, this is a terribly funny book. And I'm like, this isn't funny at all. Like, when your idea of humour is South Park, I think, you're never going to get
In many ways, my idea of humour is
still South Park. But now it's also...
Yeah, it's also Jane Austen as well. But there's also something, there's so much you said there that I want to light on, but like, there's something so annoying about when like, people insist to you that an old thing is funny.
Yes. Oh,
or like a play is funny.
You're like, no one's falling over. Like, crack a joke.
And it's like, so my, crack a fucking joke. And also it's like this version of humour that, yes, absolutely is funny. Mm. Like, Jane Austen, the wittiest writer who ever lived. No one's coming for that throne at all. It's her and it's David Sedaris.
Match made in heaven.
Exactly. But it's that sort of, it's a kind of a humour that you do have to train your ear to hear.
Yes.
And it's like, and if you're zoned out from it or if you're not interested, which I greatly respect Austen, but I'm not like, I can't get hard for her the way other people can. Like,
no, I'm not like an Austen horny head. For it. Yes, exactly. And maybe that's why the 1995 version doesn't quite do it for me, because it's too Austen almost. It feels a little bit to me like homework in a way that's unfair. Like it is brilliant. I'm splitting hairs here because I do think they're both really brilliant. But you can hear how defensive I'm getting about it because people are always like, ugh, you like the movie? Like, that's an unserious opinion.
It's funny. So, like, obviously, this is a kind of like a Russian nesting doll of sentimental garbage now, because Austen itself, not shameful. As everyone is ready to be like, okay,
although, I don't
fabulous.
Know. I think still in certain circles, being an Austen head is a bit like literature light, you know?
Yes. So the thing is, it's like, as a broad thing, it's like, yes, she's going to be there on the shelf next to Dickens and Thackeray, and like, no one's going to argue that. But within that, the fandom of Austen is quite cringe.
Yes.
Like, we've all met a woman at a party whose cat is called Mr. Darcy, and we don't want to hang out with her.
No, you're like inching towards the kitchen, like, oh, I need to refill. Yeah, you don't want to be stuck with Mr. Darcy cat girl at the party.
Oh no, people are going to write in now.
They are also often, no, that's too unfair. I can't say this. They're American sometimes in the bad way. And sometimes people are American in the bad way.
Sometimes people are American in the bad way. And that's not just they own a gun. It's
there's that other bad way that we both are thinking about now with Mr. Darcy Cat.
Yes. Mr. Darcy American Catwoman.
I'm so sorry.
Mr. Darcy colon American Catwoman.
That's the adaptation everyone's actually waiting for.
Yeah, it is.
That's so rude, though. I apologize.
No, it's so rude. But this, if I'm gonna like successfully make a podcast about snobbery, we have to be like fair and truthful about identifying snobbery.
Yes.
In the culture and in ourselves.
Yes, that was a snobby thing to say, and I stand by it 100%.
Mr. Darcy, American Catwoman. Yeah, she's way too into it.
She's way too into it. She's maybe even got some of the costumes.
She's got them.
She went to the Bridgerton live experience.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're absolutely fleeing from her in the kitchen at a party. So those people are looked down on.
So that is the first Russian nesting doll within Jane Austen snobbery. And then the nesting doll within that is this movie.
Yes.
Which is like, not only are you Mr. Darcy American Catwoman, but you also don't have the good taste or the patience or the sort of like aesthetic sensibility to favour the 6-hour adaptation Jennifer Ealing and Colin Firth. And so you found yourself at the thinnest end of the wedge of Jane Austen snobbery.
Really, really hemmed in here by all kinds of different people being like, you're an idiot.
What do you think is so good about it?
I was talking to my sister about this the other day, because actually independently of each other, she's 10 years younger than me, so it's not like we were watching this together. This is, for both of us, the comfort movie. Like, things are crap. I just need something that's going to be so pleasant and soothing. For both of us, it's this. And we were talking about why that is. And she said, for her, she was like, it's pretty simple. It's very escapist. Mm-hmm. And nothing really bad happens. Which I guess is true from a sort of 21st century perspective. Even the, like, quote unquote, bad things that happen, like the Wicca marriage and things. Mm-hmm. Now we're a bit like, oh, but they, you know, it's fine. Because it wouldn't be.
And in all adaptations, the threat is so short. Do you know what I mean? Even in the really long BBC version, it's kind of over and done with in what feels like about half an hour.
Yeah, and it's so quick in this. I mean, she gets that letter, and you know the bit where Kira comes into the room, and she's like, ah! And then like, goes out again. And the whole thing is taken care of within about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So I think it's that. It's like mild peril, like you get in movies for kids. And also, I don't know, we were getting sort of soppy about it, and it was like, oh, it makes me wish I had three more sisters. And because neither
of
us, I think, also because we're so different in age, we never really had the like hand-holding, squealing about clothes phase of our relationship. So maybe it's a sort of sublimated sister thing. I don't know. It also just slaps. I just think it's a really well-made film.
It just fucking slaps is the thing. And like, which is not to take away anything from the fact that the BBC one also slaps.
No, I mean, let's just add that. Let's just imagine that we've said that after every time we say that this one is good.
Yes.
Insert
precisely.
Listeners
it's like
in your
when
head.
You're, when you're bitching about a friend.
Yes.
And at the top of the conversation. Now, obviously, we both love her.
Yeah.
And she's kind and wonderful and often funny.
But can I be mean for a second?
Yeah. And while we have this horrible conversation about our dear friend.
Who we love.
Let's pretend that that's the pinned tweet at the top of the thing.
Yes.
We love her. And that's how we're... Yeah. But like, there is this thing with... and that version of Pride and Prejudice inspired so many other, like, you know, I think it became the sort of the case test for doing period dramas in a very considered, serious, wonderful, beautiful way. But the filmmaking is not interesting, really.
No.
It's kind of, the camera stays at the same place in the room the whole time. It's basically, it's kind of shot like a play.
Yeah.
People come in wearing the nightgowns in these very proper sets. And they come in and they do their lines and there's never a sense that, like...
It's a bit lifeless to
me. It's a little bit lifeless, yes. That's the word.
Like, when I think of the adaptation, the 1995 one, I think of the sound of a door closing. Just, like, it needs to happen and this is how people do move around and speak in a book, I guess. But I'm not really making a lot of sense here. The 2005 one feels way more alive and real to me, to how people actually live with one another.
Yeah, and it's that beautiful thing, that way, that opening, which I just love, of the kind of camera just hanging around the house and like you see all
through the window, the parents having that conversation.
Yes.
It's so you're really right in the shoes of a member of a family just wandering around of an afternoon. It's so unstagey feeling.
It makes me really emotional. Maybe it's because of the music, because I think anyone who writes has a really deep relationship with this soundtrack.
Do you also write to this music?
Yes, I do.
Is there anybody who doesn't?
Is there anyone who's written a novel in the last 15 years who hasn't
done
written
to this soundtrack? But it's so, I don't know what it is, it's crack. It's like you put it on and you're like, just the words come out.
Yeah, it's magic.
It's really insane. If you're listening to this and you haven't done this, do immediately turn the podcast off.
Yeah.
Go to your desk.
And in general, I feel like very very intimate with the films of Keira Knightley, because I just, when I've really wrung out the Pride and Prejudice soundtrack, I just go, Keira Knightley soundtrack. And I'm like, I've listened to all the Anna Karenina soundtrack.
Oh, is that good too?
It's fabulous.
Okay, amazing.
The Atonement soundtrack, the Colette soundtrack, like...
Oh my gosh.
If Keira's in it, it's going to have a beautiful score.
See, for me, it's this. It's the Pride and Prejudice soundtrack, and unfortunately, it's one track from The Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah, I have that
as
well.
The Breaking of the Fellowship, where Sam and Frodo are in the boat about to go across the river and he nearly drowns.
Yeah.
Don't know why. Just that does something to me.
That really upsets
like,
me.
Like, it's time to go to Mordor, bitch. Sit down.
Yeah, and maybe that is why. Because, like, when I threw it on the other day to rewatch it for this, I hadn't seen it in maybe 5 years. Mm. And I just immediately started crying. And I couldn't tell if it's because the music is inherently emotional, the story is inherently emotional, or I've had so many emotional moments to the soundtrack.
Yeah, it's the perfect melting pot of things that are going to make you weep.
Yeah, and just like, and I get this with Little Women a lot as well, just like, just the concept of sisters.
Yeah, it's so like, when you actually boil it down, it's pretty basic. It's like, women love each other so much and I like that. But no, the Little Women thing is actually, when I was watching it again... In recent years, watching it after Little Women came out, there is no Little Women without this film. Like, there's no way
Greta Gerwig
could have made, would even have thought to make it, I think. Surely she's seen this, because it's that whole sort of talking over each other thing, the girlishness of it all, I think was new to this as a period adaptation thing.
And the sense of like, and I think this is when Austin feels at her like best, and When you, like, sometimes I pick up an Austen book and I'm like, what did it twere so simple? Like, my countenance does not permit me. Like, and I'm like, fuck off. Just go away. And like, and then sometimes it just hits. And I think it depends on what day of my cycle I'm on. But you just really feel... with Austen more than any other writer from that period, like, she's somebody who knew she was in the past.
Ooh.
In the sense that, like, there's this rage bubbling over the page. And you get that with like the scene where Charlotte Lucas is getting married, yes, and Mr. Collins and everything, where you feel like this is somebody who really sees the society they're in, really hates it, knows it will change, but yes, also knows that she will be dead before it does. And I just, oof, I just feel that with her more than any other writer from that period.
Yeah, that's a really good point. God, the Charlotte Lucas thing. I mean, it's not a surprise that that line has become a sort of meme. The, what is it? I'm unmarried, I'm already a burden to my parents.
I'm 27.
And I'm frightened. I'm there like 31, like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Fine.
All these like 27-year-old girls on TikToks being like, girl, same.
And I've written down in my document here what I've called the Stations of the Cross of Pride and Prejudice. Because like the Stations of the Cross, it's like you can't have any Pride and Prejudice adaptation without hitting these beats.
Yeah.
And we begin the first major beat after the like going through the house. Oh, look, here's like some flower arranging they're doing. Here's my pig. And we have the Netherfield,
yes,
Manor has been, Netherfield Manor, is that it? Has been let at last.
Yes. It is Netherfield, isn't it?
Yes. I can't remember if it's a manor or a house. Or...
again, I'm going to hear you've been murdered with like a gold letter. I think it is.
Yeah. And I mean, Mrs. Bennett is the G of the movie. Like,
she is the G. Now, and I'm going to say something controversial here, which is that I do prefer Alison Steadman as Mrs. Bennett.
Me too. Just because she's perfect.
Just because who else, you know?
And she's Gavin's mum.
And she's Gavin's
from sorry,
mom.
Gavin and Stacey, yes, not my husband. That would be
and
mad.
Also not like Lord and Lady Gavin from...
I just like when I was rewatching the BBC the other day, and I realized that it was.
I have so many things like that because if you're our age, I don't know. Yeah. I didn't really know who Alison Steadman was before Gavin and Stacey, yeah, and now everything I watch, I'm like, oh my god, Gavin's mom is here.
Gavin's mom is here, my little prince, so good. This Mrs. Bennett,
yes,
is very good.
She's
like
very good too.
Bridget Jones, when she's giving that speech at the book launch, like, and Mr. Archer, your books are very good.
Your books
also
are very good. Also.
And I feel there's been a lot of in the past few years because it's constantly a reappraisal of this book because it never falls out of fashion because it's always relevant because the story remains to be about like, well, which women get to get married, yeah, which women don't get to get married, and that will unfortunately always be relevant. And this sort of redressing of like the Bennett parents. Well, yeah, actually, he's kind of a nightmare, and she's the only, and she's worrying because she has to.
Yes, I like the Bennett parent relationship in this one also more than in the 1995 one, because I feel like you understand Mrs. Bennett better in this one. Mm. The Alison Steadman one, she's more silly, which is more fun.
Yeah,
but less sympathetic and less. I don't think it could be quite so moving without having changed that parental relationship a little bit. Also, that Donald Sutherland is such
so
a
good
sweetheart,
yeah,
and so sympathetic and lovable, rather than being, if I'm remembering this rightly, in the other one, he's a little bit of a crank.
A little, yeah, there's a more of a sense in Donald Sutherland one that he is like, his sort of like disinterest and his removal and his like, well, all my daughters suck except for Lizzie, sort of. It feels more fond and it feels like it's said with more of a wink and a bit of a Santa Claus-y,
yes,
kind of
exactly,
like twinkle.
It feels like it's born of having five daughters for 20 years. Like, yeah, I know men like this who have five daughters, you know, yeah, like friends' parents, who are so placid.
Yeah.
Because they, like, they're just done. You know, there's been so much
they've been
screaming.
Buffeted by the storms of estrogen.
Yeah, and they're just, you'll see them in the, yeah, chair in their living room just, like, absolutely melted in.
I don't often feel sorry for men, but the idea that you could, like, have five different women in your house going through puberty,
oh,
and also a woman in menopause who's also mental to begin with.
Yes, I'm thinking of a specific man I'm not going to name, and I do feel extremely sorry for him.
Does he listen to the podcast?
I would be so surprised. He's more of a, like, Malcolm Gladwell type.
I see.
I'm not sure how big the Venn diagram crossover is there.
Malcolm Gladwell would play a good Mr. Bennett, I think. It's a version of Mr. Bennett I would be interested in seeing.
Ooh, see, you can just do it again and again and again.
Again and again.
Never stops giving.
Yeah. There's a bit, yeah, I think you're right in that Mrs. Bennett makes a bit more sense, or she's a bit more empathetic in this one. Like, there's a bit where she meets Lizzie on the stairs and she sort of says to Lizzie, like, when you have five daughters, then yes. Like, then talk to me then kind of thing.
Yeah. And the bit after Lydia goes off with Wickham, where she's looking out the window and she's like, you know, it's so sad to be parted with your children. And she seems genuinely really sad, not just kind of... There are other parts where you feel like she's going through the motions a bit and being emotional because it's sort of funny. But yeah, she feels like a real genuine character in this one.
Yeah, and the kind of the dual thing of like, oh, wow. That's the kind of the magic with Prime Minister as well, is that like you have to be aware of this low-lying threat that they are kind of fucked. Like, unless they can just sort of trick rich men into marrying them, which only half of them are ever interested in doing half of the time.
Yes.
They are sort of screwed.
Yeah.
And the thing of like, yeah, she desperately wants them to not be homeless and starving.
Yeah, no, the stakes are real.
And yet never offensive.
Never too real.
Never too real, you know what I mean? Whereas, like, Sense and Sensibility, the stakes are made very real in the opening scenes, where it's like, oh, they've been booted out.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So shortly after we meet the Bennet parents, we meet the Bennet girls, and it's Rosamund Pike playing Jane, which is perfect casting.
Yes.
Never did like the other Jane, to be honest.
No, she... Yes, she had a sort of sorry for herself look that I didn't like.
Right. It was very wet.
Yeah.
I didn't root for her in the same way I automatically root for Rosamund Pike anytime I see her.
Yes, agreed.
And you really do, and I feel like you really do believe that she is just like a really nice hot girl.
Yeah, yeah. She doesn't feel wet at all. And she does feel sincerely heartbroken later in the film. And trying to kind of hide it for everybody else's benefit. She's just a brilliant actress, I think. Like,
she's so brilliant. And like, yeah, and I think Jane is probably the... obviously, Kitty and Lydia are somewhat interchangeable in terms of their characterization. Yeah. But she is quite a thinly drawn character on the page. She's just like, well, the thing about me is I'm very nice.
You're so nice, Lizzie.
Yeah. Just so nice. Oh, couldn't possibly be. Maybe they're both mistaken.
Yeah, exactly. So you need... I think you need an actress with like a lot of presence.
Yeah.
To make up for that kind of slight deficiency in the character. Like, she's got to feel... like there are depths she's not showing, not that there are no depths. You know?
Yes, yes. And like, that's why I really root for her and Mr. Bingley, because they're like, oh, they're just two nice hotties.
I know.
And he's they so exist. Sweet.
You know, they used to date.
I know.
Before the movie. I mean, we can talk about that maybe later, the whole Rosamund Pike of it all. Do you know this about Joe Wright?
No. Let's go into it now, though. Well, we're on Jane. Let's just go for it.
Rosamund Pike. So first of all, Simon Wood, who plays Bingley, was her ex-boyfriend, but that was fine and amiable.
Yeah.
Joe Wright, who directed the movie, started dating during the filming of Pride and Prejudice. They then got engaged. They did save the dates, all of that, and he called it off.
What?
Yeah. The director of Pride and Prejudice jilted Jane. And she gave an interview to The Guardian like shortly afterwards where she was like, I don't know why.
What?
I know!
What?
This was me when I found this out a few years ago. I was like, head blown.
Is she with anyone now?
Imagine jilting Rosamund Pike.
What? What did he find out?
I have no...
What is she hiding?
What is she hiding? What is he hiding? It's fascinating. But there's like...
Men don't call off engagements.
It's...
I just don't think they do. Whenever I hear a called off engagement, it's always a woman.
Isn't it?
Ooh, I guess because men are generally the ones doing the proposing.
I have always assumed it was his fault because he's a man, with apologies. But maybe you're right. That is weird that he called it off.
I don't know why my mind immediately went to Rosamund Pike as a terrible secret.
Well, Gone Girl.
Like she's one
That's
of
why.
The Flowers in the Attic children or Gone Girl.
Yeah. But yes, so there's layers within layers.
Oh my God. Wow.
This whole thing.
So then we have Keira Knightley playing Lizzie, who was always going to be like the most important or the central role, the most beloved heroine of literature. And there's a real sharpness and difference to how Keira Knightley plays it versus how Jennifer Ely plays it, or Eel, never quite sure. There's like a sweetness to Jennifer Ely's one where it's very like, she's always got this sort of smile in the corner of her mouth and a delicacy and like, well, you know.
Yes.
If only my countenance would allow it.
Annoying a little bit.
Do you think?
Maybe I'm just playing favourites.
I am recording another episode on the BBC One tomorrow with the beautiful Carrie Ed Lloyd. And tomorrow, that'll be my favourite one.
Great.
Today, this is my favourite one.
Well, I'll come in and we can fight outside the studio.
But there's a kind of a bitingness and a sarcasm. I heard one podcast describe it as there's something about how Keira Knightley plays it and how she shot that's very Jim from The Office. It's very like something happens and it just sort of zones in on Keira making eyes at the camera. Not quite breaking the fourth wall, but being like, can you believe this bitch kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very like knowing.
Yes.
Yes.
In which is in some ways feels like so... It really makes the production kind of totally come to life because she feels like a modern girl. And other times it feels kind of anachronistic that, you know, like, would she really talk to Catherine de Bourgh that way? I don't think so.
No.
You know?
I quite like, though, in general, the way that the production is pretty loose with anachronisms. I mean, it's not like a pair of trainers, but the things like that in terms of the way people talk and hairstyles, even stuff. I think it's kind of nice. You know, I'm not bothered, but then I'm not a Mr. Darcy American Cat girl. So maybe... Like, if you were, you can see why some of that stuff would really annoy you. That it isn't true to how Austen would have imagined these, you know, sacred characters.
That stuff simply never annoys me.
No, I just don't care.
No, I just don't care.
You know, when you see, like, Twitter threads from some dude where he's like, actually, the watch that Napoleon is wearing in this scene wasn't invented until... It's like, I don't care! I just don't. I'm so sorry.
I just... Yeah, it's a really... But it's the same with when any kind of book I love is adapted. Mm. I really rarely care as to like whether or not they included this plot point or this character, or like I can basically always understand why you would cut something for time or whatever. It's like it's so much more about staying true to the spirit of a thing than it is the letter of a thing.
Yeah, true.
And I think another thing that annoyed people about this adaptation was there's a kind of a muddiness to it as well. Mm-hmm. Like there's literal mud everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they moved the time frame forward by like 40 or 50 years.
Or back. Yeah.
Ugh,
so it was like...
That. Yeah, which way?
I think it's normally adapted for like High Regency, which is
like what, 1830s,
yeah.
This is 1790.
Yes.
Which they apparently did partly in order to have that slightly like muddy... down at heel look for the Bennets.
Yeah.
Like that would have been a bit more normal. But I love that.
I love that.
It's so, the kind of, it's not gritty, it's Jane Austen, but you know what I mean? Like it feels quite real and you can smell the pigs when you watch the film, which I think is a good thing.
And I think it was so smart in that like one of the reasons they said it a bit earlier was that they wanted to get away from those nightgowns.
Oh my God.
Those fucking Empire line dresses.
They are vile.
They're vile. And I read something interesting about it, and I'm not sure if it's true, but it's that because of the Napoleonic Wars, which were happening during the Regency period, and because all corsetry came from France, and like in general was thought of being a very French thing, that the Empire line dresses came in as a show of patriotism that people weren't...
No way.
Yeah, wearing French underwear.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
But... Thank God. I think they look so much nicer. And without their boobs up around their eyeballs, it's just...
And then just like there's nothing, it's ghost outfits.
Yeah, just
bleh. Awful. And like horrible in the whites and creams and pinks.
Oh God.
Just...
And like texturally kind of a nightmare as well. The kind of like weird sheen on everything.
Yes, totally. And gross. Like, and also it sort of like, it visually distinguishes itself from the other one, which is smart. And just they look beautiful in those dresses. They're flattering. I like them.
That brown dress that Keira Knightley's wearing in the first ball is just like perfect. Perfect.
Yes. Oh, can't wait to get to the ball. Let's move down the sisters. Then we've got Carey Mulligan. No, wait, sorry. First we've got Mary.
Oh, is Mary in the middle? I know.
Mary's in the middle. Yeah, Mary's after Lizzie and before the two girls.
God bless Mary. She's such a... Poe face.
I have so many thoughts and theories. I think Mary might be my favourite.
I love her scenes in this. I mean, Tallulah Riley is also like, she's so dour looking in this and so like sulky. But
she's so beautiful.
She's so beautiful that she feels, I don't know, I feel like I know people like that who are just kind of like wallflowery, kind a little bit boring. And a little bit lost in their own world, but kind of lovable for it.
I feel like there's something of Austen in the creation of Mary, in like a disdain for her own fan base at that point, of like meeting these really like pernickety, annoying women and being like, I love you. I don't know if even the culture of the time would have allowed for that.
Yes.
But is that, do you think?
I think.
You think?
I think there's something to that.
Because she, Mary does seem like a parody of a literature fangirl.
Yes. Yes, I hadn't actually thought of it that way. That is a good point.
Because like her love of a thing has made her, has given like her love of like books and reading and learning has given like her a safe place outside of a world that she can't really figure out. She doesn't like dancing. She doesn't like balls.
Yes.
She doesn't really like people that much. Her sisters are way too loud and big and she's very small. But like reading has given her a world of like comfort and safety. And therefore, when she is forced to be in the real world, she kind of brings that imagined world with her.
Yes.
And it's delivered in such a smug, horrible, annoying, boring way.
awful. The bit where she's playing piano at the ball and sort of warbling and everyone's laughing at her but she can't really tell and her dad tells her to get up and stop playing.
It's my just dear, like, you have delighted us long enough.
Whoa. Yeah. God.
Awful. I also think, like, obviously for drama it's better that Charlotte Lucas marries Mr. Collins. But I was like, why doesn't Mary marry him?
They would have been great.
Yeah,
they would have been a good match. Oh, yeah. Missed opportunity.
Between, like, while we're on Mary, I was going to co-opt it to Mr. Collins for a while.
Oh, he is so... Tom Hollander.
Tom Hollander, yeah.
There shouldn't be two. One of them has to do something about that.
One must die.
Tom Hollander is so fucking funny in this film.
He makes me howl.
That thing you said at the beginning about the most exquisite potatoes or whatever it is so good. Every line is just delivered in the funniest way I can imagine.
It's so good. And like I think it's him and Mary are and Charlotte Lucas as well. They're like these three characters that really help the entire thing stay current. Because there's a sense when you're either reading it or watching any version of it and you're like, oh, there are always people who are just a fucking pain in the ass.
Yes.
There are
always. I mean, they're not reading you Fordyce's sermons anymore, but they're doing something equivalent.
Yeah.
Bores are eternal.
There's something very comforting about that. And like, and I think because like the Janes and the Lizzies and the Mr. Darcys, they're so heightened and they're so romantic. And they're not really like, the thing with Lizzie Bennet is that she's a wish fulfillment character who always says the thing that you wish you said in an argument.
Yes, she's the sister everybody flatters themselves that they are, but some of us are Marys. Yeah.
The thing is, if you think you're a Lizzie, you're probably a Mary.
You're probably a Mary. Oh God, that's sad. True.
Then we've got the two at the end.
Yes.
Carey Mulligan's first role.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And Jenna Malone.
Who's American.
Yeah. Who I know mostly from being in The Hunger Games.
Oh my God, of course. That's it. Thank you. I was watching it the other day and being like, you look familiar from something else now.
Yeah. Such strange casting.
Really strange.
I mean, she does a great job.
Yeah, she does. But what? Yeah.
But you must have thought that there must have been so many just English actresses around who could do that job.
I mean, I did not clock her accent.
At all. No.
So she must have been doing a good job.
Yeah.
They're a bit interchangeable personality-wise in this one. I can't actually remember what they're like in the 1995
Kind of the same.
Version.
They just kind of collapse in and out of rooms giggling together.
Which is fun. I don't mind that.
It is fun.
Yeah, it makes me think of, you know, this is such a niche reference, you know the two little bugs from A Bug's Life that do like, stand on top of each other? That's the vibe that they have.
It's so that vibe! But and I think they're important as well, even though they have virtually no lines. Like, Lydia has a few more once she gets married and she comes back and she's just so funny.
Yeah.
She's like, my sisters can write to me.
Married women never have time to write.
But I think there's something really important because it's so dialogue heavy and it's so like people having these pretty exacting little chats where they skewer each other neatly. And if it was wall to wall that, it would become so knackering on the ear and on like just your concentration. And so it almost like in the way that you need to have physical comedy in rom-coms to sort of break up the dialogue or music numbers or whatever. Mm-mm. Just having like Lydia and Kitty just collapse into a room laughing, being insane, really helps break up those scenes.
I think, they're absolutely crucial. It would be so dull without them, even if all they're doing, as you say, is screaming about officers and, like, throwing ribbons around.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, sometimes we're screaming about officers and throwing ribbons around. It's not all like, I love you madly. You know, there has to be room for... That's what I mean. That's why it feels alive, is because there's a lot of just, like, normal shit in there, like women just being.
In terms of like a structured piece, it is, it's so perfect. And like in every character, there's the kind of a weight and a counterweight, you know?
Mm.
Like you have Lizzie at the center. You have Jane, who's kind of like the more idealized version of Lizzie, who's kind of everything that she wishes that she was but can't be. And we love her because she can't be that.
Mm.
But you also have Charlotte Lucas, who's like representing sort of a kind of a dark side of what could happen to Lizzie if she gave up on the dream of romantic love and actually liking the person you're married to.
Yes.
And then all those sisters are sort of just weigh each other out so well.
Mm.
So we've talked about basically everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And now on to Mr. Darcy. Who I name my cat after.
So. Of course. As we all do. I am in love with Matthew McFadyen.
Really?
Yes. He's my dream man. It's him and Niles from Frasier, for some reason, are like, I don't know. So, I was always going to like this film because I fancy him. Let's just have that out.
Did you fancy him prior to?
No.
Okay.
I fancied him first in this movie.
Yeah.
And the fancying has never abated.
Okay.
And I hope I will never be free. he has bewitched me, body and soul. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I love his Darcy. I like it a lot more than the Colin Firth one. He's too snippy. He's too arrogant. He's too... He likes himself a bit. Not likes himself. What do I mean? He thinks he's smart.
Mm.
This one, I just think this Darcy is... He has no idea how to be. He's socially awkward and shy and quiet.
Yes.
Which comes across as arrogance, which is so true to how loads of people are. I'm sure you've met people like this where you're like, ugh, what a prick. And then it turns out that they're just,
oh my God,
quiet.
Every time I meet a really hot woman who's also shy,
it's
I'm
so
like,
confusing.
What a bitch.
Yes. But even though I know this,
yeah,
like, is a very widely shared character trait of people, every time I'm the same, I'm like, you... Fuck you. Like, you don't know what to say? Fuck you. I don't want to talk to you anymore. So I love that it's... I can't think of... I'm sure there are, but I can't think of many other characters who are like that off the top of my head.
I do agree with you in that I do think that the Matthew McFadyen character or portrayal is just less fanciable. It does sort of leave me cold. I'm sorry to argue
with
you.
Well, maybe that's a personal preference thing. I like a shy, quiet man. So maybe
I don't.
Well, there we go. I think he's so... I think it's just such a brilliant portrayal of this character and makes it different from the Colin Firth. Because the shadow cast by the Colin Firth, Mr. Darcy, is so long.
Because Colin Firth has been franchising out Mr. Darcy his entire career.
Exactly. Like, I'm sure they had a nightmare casting it. You know, who are you going to get to do Darcy that's not Colin Firth?
Especially if, like, I can't remember what years the two Bridget Jones movies came out.
There was certainly one in 2007, maybe the second one?
Yeah, possibly.
So yeah, it was around that
time.
So he's
still, in a sense, playing Mr. Darcy.
Yes,
know?
Exactly.
He's still around and very much fresh in our heads as the eternal Darcy, which must be a strange thing for him to live with.
It must be pretty weird.
Yeah, because it's almost like being, you know, one of the cast of Friends or something, where you are stuck in the minds of everybody
as that
forever. But In terms of his career, is actually quite a small percentage of what he spent his time doing.
A tiny one. And also the man must be, what, 60 now?
Yeah.
But I do... I mean, he did that very worthy, annoying Oscar movie, King's Speech. He did that.
I like it!
I've only actually half seen it once. Maybe it's good and I just am being unfair. But
the thing is that he can't speak, but he also... He must make a speech.
So
it's a double meaning, Imogen. The king's speech. And the king's speech. So now you understand.
Wow. Yes, okay, sorry. I hadn't got it, I think, until now. I can't wait to watch it now that I understand the premise.
So, I'm so glad to have cleared that up for you. And so it must have been this impossible thing. And even though on a bloodlust level, I remain neutral for Matthew McFadden in all his guises. I do totally see how, like, that depiction of somebody who's legitimately awkward and, like, sort of has this kind of, like, panicked expression. And he's also, his, like, hugeness feels very awkward.
Yes. And I think it's so lovable. Like, a large, shy man. That's a tough thing to be.
Yeah. In this world.
It is.
It actually is. Like, I'm with the large, not shy man. And it just, the amount of time, if you're a man over 6 foot and over a certain kind of width, people are just like, oh, hey, big guy. Wouldn't want to get inside of you, wrong side of you is a fight. What? Like,
right. I
people
have,
are just constantly talking about your size. It's horrible.
Really, it's really horrible. I have a friend who's very tall, about 6 foot six, and very shy. And when we used to go out as teenagers, people would try and start fights with him all the time.
Yeah.
And he'd get so upset and have to go home. Because it was really upsetting.
Yeah.
And he just happened not to be as macho as he looked.
It's, I just can't fathom what that life is like.
Neither. It's fascinating. But I think that he is doing it in this adaptation.
Yeah.
He's embodying that thing where you're like, you look a certain way and people assume you must be a certain way.
Yeah.
But you're just not.
Yeah. Yeah. But then, okay, it's interesting because, like, the choices in his performance, which is to play somebody who's sort of too big for the room and just sort of too big to hang out. Like, he really is.
Too big to hang out.
He is too big to hang out. The monster on the hill. It's genuinely awkward and doesn't want to dance with anyone because he's awkward. Mm. But then the yin of that versus the yang of, like, having him say lines like, oh, like, you know, calling Lizzie Bennet barely tolerable and not beautiful enough to tempt me. And
so I sort of wonder about that line, because I feel like it can be read as a slight just brush off to his friend. Like, leave me alone, you know, I don't want to talk about it. Because when he comes into the room and sees her for the first time, he does that classic, like, awkward man with a crush thing where he, like, looks and then immediately looks away.
Yeah.
Like, do not perceive me thing. And there's so many bits like that in the movie. Like, when she comes to the house where Jane gets sick. What is the name of that house? Too many houses.
Netherfield.
Longbourn?
No, they live in Longbourn and Bingley has left Netherfield.
Yes.
For God's sake,
I just, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. When she arrives there and comes into the room where he and this bitch sister, what's her name?
Caroline Bingley,
are having breakfast, and he stands up really suddenly and awkwardly and his chair sort of moves underneath him.
Yeah.
All things like that, which are like, like a little boy who likes someone and doesn't know what to do about it. I just find it so charming.
It is nice. And I just think that in terms of, like, filmmaking, the dance scene is, like, absolutely peerless.
The first one.
So good.
Awesome.
No, maybe this is the second one. Maybe this is the ball at Netherfield.
Yes.
Where they dance. I think it's because Mr. Collins is there as well.
That is so, it's comedy genius, that thing of him, like, trying to talk to her and then
and
then she moves away and he keeps speaking and then she comes back.
It's so much is so amazing about that scene. Like, if that scene was just Mr. Collins struggling to talk to Lizzie, or just Darcy and Lizzie connecting, it would be great, but the fact that it's both of those things.
Oh, and the bit where all of the other dancers disappear.
Yeah.
And it's just the two of them.
And it's so quick. And it's almost like if you were looking at your phone for a second,
you'd miss it.
But it's so like,
it's great. And actually that whole party thing, when it does that amazing camera track thing where it's following, you know, Mr. Collins is looking for Lizzie, and then it's the two sisters getting drunk, and then it's Mrs. Bennet bragging about Jane in the corner.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so, again, so Little Women. Reminds me so much of that scene where they go to a dance.
Yeah.
In the early part of that movie.
Yes.
It's a ball that looks fun. Like, you would actually want to go. Whereas, like, so many period things, you're like, meh.
You do want, like, you're so right. It actually does remind me of the Greta Gerwig party scene where you have Timothée Chalamet and Saoirse Ronan dancing between the windows.
That one. Ugh.
Which always makes me cry.
I think maybe you just cry quite a lot.
I just cry a lot.
I know what you mean. There's something very touching about that.
Yeah. And just, like, I don't know why there aren't more dance movies in general, or more movies that, like,
feature a little dance.
We love to watch it as people.
We do, that's true.
And, like, just the watching their heads sort of, like, bob slowly, and it's so sexy and the music is so beautiful, and the way how stiff they are, but how teasing, and that thing of like, oh, and perhaps you could comment on the number of partners or the size of the room, or maybe
it's that thing of like it being sexier to wear clothes than be naked. It's like it's all the potential is there, but they can't let any of it out except in these very like tiny teasy ways.
Yes. Yeah, it's so neggy and so hot.
Yeah.
Ugh. And I love the whole thing with Lizzie and Jen, and it's so women. Women.
Women.
So women of like women who have like spent, and this is all, and this is again another reason why Pride and Prejudice will never go out of style. Which is like women who have spent their entire lives being chastised and reminded that they have to always sort of be pleasing and polite in a room and make conversation with everyone, including the people you're not really that interested in, and, you know, being nice and asking how you are and all that kind of stuff. And then the kind of how furious she is Darcy thinks that he can just be above social conventions and being sound to people, you know?
Yeah, it's really satisfying.
It's very women.
You're so right. It's a wish fulfillment thing. The whole character of Lizzie is just like, if you were a little bit of a bad bitch, this is what you'd have said in all those situations you've been in.
Exactly. Oh, so good. And then we go straight from the second ball to like bam, 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 event. There are so many fucking events.
There's so many events. I'm amazed they managed to even do it. Like, because there's even more events in the book of like so-and-so coming and turning up and giving a letter, and then they learn this, and then they go here, and then they...
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel... I mean, it feels more bam, 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 as you say, towards the end of the movie than the early parts.
Yeah. It's amazing that something with this... Because like they fit in all the stations of the cross, the sort of like both balls, Lydia going away, Wickham arriving, Darcy coming and going, all this stuff, without it feeling that rushed.
Yeah.
A little bit towards the end, maybe, but that just feels like momentum more than it being rushed.
Yes, no, I agree with that. Yeah, it does pick up the pace, but not in a way that makes you feel like they're kind of racing to the end.
Yeah. It slot in so perfectly. And then, okay, so we have the second ball, at which point Caroline Bingley, who we haven't spoken enough about, is like... don't like how this is going. I'm going to just convince my brother. Like, the power that woman has.
I know.
Convince my brother to go to London for the winter. Jane's heartbroken. And then they all just like, I find this really mean. Because like, the old separate girls, three separate girls are invited on three separate trips.
Yes.
Leaving Kitty and Mary just at home.
Just at home.
So Jane goes to London.
Yeah.
To sort of be tangential to the Bingleys.
Yes.
In case they need her.
Yeah.
Lizzie goes to the Peak District with her aunt and uncle for reasons. And Lydia goes to Brighton with her aunt and other aunt and uncle.
Other aunt, yes. Yeah. Too many aunts, too many uncles.
Yeah, yeah. And Jane, nothing happens over there.
No.
Lizzie goes to Pemberley.
Yes.
It's like the most thing of like, oh, I get it.
Oh, like, oh. Oh, so you're rich, rich.
Oh, you're rich, rich. And by this point, she's already turned down Darcy's proposal.
Yes, exactly. Which in this film, I think, this is something that people get mad about, right? It's like, it's supposed to happen in a parsonage. It's like, yeah, but look at it. Look at the scene they've given you instead. How are you mad? It's gorgeous. It's raining.
Raining in the gazebo.
Oh, and they nearly kiss after she says no. Oh my gosh, it's like,
Oh, it's so good. Chills. Yeah.
So yes, she's turned him down and then gone off on this little holiday.
Yes.
And her aunt and uncle have been like, well, maybe we should visit Pemberley. And weirdly, she's like, yeah, let's go. I guess she thinks he's not going to be there, but even so.
Yeah. Again, that feels very today of like just being somewhere with an elderly aunt and uncle being like, we're going to go to a National Trust property and look at the stuff.
Yes, exactly.
Like, okay.
But also very today in like, I don't know, this is maybe a slightly like idiot point, but she couldn't just like go on the computer and find out more about him. She had to go to his house. And she got the opportunity to go to his house.
And see his sculpture.
Yes.
Someone made that sculpture.
True.
Matthew McFadden.
Yes. Oh my God, I wonder where it is now.
I wonder where it is now. It's like Carrie's tutu.
Oh.
So she has to contend with that she turned down the richest man in the world.
Yes. Who then appears to be a total sweetheart with his little...
with his sister.
Sister.
Yeah.
Georgina.
What do you make of all that?
I like it. I like
is,
it.
The thing is, I just
the
like
thing
it.
Is, I think it's really good, Caroline. And I think they did a great job. Obviously, the sister's slightly throwaway, but I think he's so... so sweet in that scene with the sister that you do kind of buy the whole thing about Georgina having been jilted by Wickham and why that was so upsetting, apart from just, oh, he disrespected my sister. It's not just a... I think before that you could be like, oh, my bloodline was disrespected. But it's like, oh, no, he really loves this little girl who was really badly hurt by this man.
Yeah.
And I just think that's so nice.
It's so nice. There's, have you ever read... What's your take on the various, like... I really like when a classic story is sort of used to illuminate different areas of life. Like, there's a contemporary novel of this called Eligible, written by Curtis Sittenfeld.
Mm.
And what I love about Curtis Sittenfeld is that she can write a really serious, big doorstepper novel that's like, this is the private life of Laura Bush. It's going to win like every prize under the sun. And then she'll just be like, I'm going to write a rom-com that's a modern retelling of Pride and Prejudice.
You're so right. She has a dream career.
She has a dream career.
She
and everyone just loves it.
Yeah, it's like, great, more.
More, whatever you fancy,
anything.
Curtis. Anything. Anyway, she did a version of this where, and some of it is so fabulous and really, really works. And like, for example, Mr. Darcy is a heart surgeon who doesn't want to have kids. And that's why he's unmarried, because he's like really dedicated to like, he never wants to have kids. And Lizzie also never wants to have kids.
Oh, dedicated and, to the heart, the but not his own.
It's very that. And also in that, Georgiana Darcy is...
that's it, Georgiana.
That's it. And she's this like teenager who has very recently been hospitalized with anorexia.
Oh.
And it's really heartwarming watching those characters look after each other. And it's also this thing of like, this thing with Georgiana Darcy, which is always like, it's kind of like damaged frailness about her.
Yes, that's perfect, actually. Yeah. Yeah, that really makes sense.
Yeah. It's actually really good.
Oh my God, I'm going to read it.
Yeah, I do.
That one happens. So they all go off on this. Well, then disaster strikes. Then she gets news of Wickham and Lydia.
Yeah. What's your take on Wickham? A real rotter.
Well, I have a notebook here that says Wickham's fuckboy ponytail.
Oh.
So that's one of the first thoughts I have about him. He's a bad man.
He's simply bad.
He's a very, very bad man. But you can see how he takes people in, I think, by the sort of woe is me.
Yeah.
Oh, like, oh, I'm so put upon and... And the fuckboy ponytail.
Fuckboy ponytail.
Who's that? What's his name? Rupert Friend?
Yes. Who then went out with Kira for years.
No.
Yeah.
See? It goes so deep.
Yeah. Everything that you read about this movie is that like everybody was kind of early enough in their careers.
Yeah.
Like, it was... Keira Knightley obviously wasn't early in her career, but she was still very young. She was like 22 or something.
Mm.
Joe Wright's first movie.
Yeah.
Carey Mulligan's first movie. And like, it's just being this magical summer where the sun shone every day and everyone fell in love.
Yes. Yeah, it was like 12 weeks or something that they shot this over.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah, so we got that brilliant scene where Keira Knightley comes out of the room and just goes...
Yeah.
So good. Your classic Darcy goes off and pays everyone off.
Yes.
What if a man loved you enough to bribe people in your name?
Ugh, the dream.
Yummy.
One day.
Lovely. And then, I mean, we haven't talked about Judi Dench's Lady Catherine de Bourgh.
You know, he wrote her a letter, Joe Wright. Also, this is his first movie. Can you imagine
making
your first movie and it's one of the best ones that have been made?
The best movie.
it's a bit strong, maybe. It's up there.
I don't think people love... I mean, he's like a great... He's a really good actor, Atonement and Anacrona and whatever. But like, I don't think people love his other movies the way they love this movie.
No, this is... Yeah, it does something special to people.
Yeah.
But Judi Dench, he wrote her a letter where he was like, I love when you play a bitch. Please come and be a bitch for me.
Yeah.
And she like made a week in her life and was like, okay, fine, I'll do it. So they had to film everything with her first. Those are all the first scenes, yeah, because she had so little time. Oh. And she's actually not in it for very long. There's those two scenes,
yeah.
But yeah, I love when she plays a bitch. And but boy, does she play a bitch.
It's such a copy of her Shakespeare in Love, Elizabeth I performance.
It is, it is. But I'm not mad about it. I love both those
God, no. Let Judi Dench do that forever.
It's so great.
That bit where she's like, no, there's no one, I think, who is as fond of music as me. Were I ever to play, I would have been a great proficient.
And the interplay between her and Mr. Collins is just, he's such a like snivelling little courtier. It's so good.
I love how like the way Mr. Collins doesn't really understand words.
No. Oh.
Like the way he uses the word condescend all the time.
The way Lady Catherine de Bourgh condescends to me.
So good.
Oh. And it's good that he's small as well. The smallness of Mr. Collins is so key. You know that bit where he tries to talk to Mr. Darcy at the ball?
Yeah.
And he has to like tap him up on the shoulder like a little boy.
I think this film, much more than the other versions, has a great empathy for Mr. Collins.
Yes, he's a loser, but you're like, it's not your fault, really.
And also, is there that much of a spiritual difference between Mr. Collins and Mr. Darcy? You know?
Ooh, is one of them just hot?
One of them's hot and rich, and one of them is not hot and poor. And it does feel like kind of a commentary on, like, how women fancy people.
Yes. Oh, that's a really good... Because also, you know, Darcy does a crap proposal of his own.
Yes, exactly. It's like, if you put those scenes alongside one another, they're not that different.
That's fascinating. And but it's so true, isn't it? Yeah. It's that thing of, like, he's a one, but there's something about him, right? Like, the sort of fanciable thing with men can often be, he's garbage.
Yeah.
But there's something about him, and it's hot to me.
And it's generally that he is tall.
And it's generally that he's tall. Or large.
Yeah.
And... that just doesn't go for women. And if you're like shy and awkward and short.
And poor.
And poor, then that's not going to fly.
Yeah. And obviously Mr. Collins is horrible. Like he is many degrees worse than Mr. Darcy.
But they're on the same
spectrum.
Scale. Yes,
yeah.
Spectrum. Maybe literally.
Quite literally. Yes. And like I feel like the film or even the characters don't know that. The film does. It shows these kind of this very melancholy moment of Mr. Collins sort of alone at the ball, like picking out a flower, kind of, she loves me not.
Oh. I just think it's the whole film is so good because it doesn't just laugh at any particular character.
Yeah.
Maybe with the exception of Lady Catherine de Bourgh.
Yeah.
But you sort of, you understand why all the characters are like this and Mr. Collins isn't just a figure of fun.
And I also understand why I would hang out with Caroline Bingley at a party. She seems funny as
hell. Yes, she does. She does. Like, she's the one. You would want to, be with her at the party.
Yeah.
But then at no other time.
No. That bit where, like, Mary's like, I think to make acquaintance, there should be no dancing at a ball. And she's like, yes, that would be better, but rather less like a ball.
Yeah, just like that.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah.
Yeah, she's a good, mean girl.
Another station of the cross of every version of Pride and Prejudice is Caroline Bingley and Lizzie Bennet.
The turn
about the room.
Which is so stupid. When you actually look at it, you're like, what are you doing?
Why are you doing it? So they can greatly admire his
skills. And that is actually maybe a moment where the characterisation that Matthew McFadden is giving Darcy doesn't quite fit with the dialogue he's been given because he's being quite smart-assed there in that scene. And I don't like him when he's like that.
No.
I like him stuttering and strange.
Gentle and shy. He's so nice. Do you have any sympathy for Caroline Bingley? I do.
Not off the top of my head.
She's a bitch, for sure. But, like, she really wants to marry Mr. Darcy. And Lizzie Bennet really got in the way of that.
I think maybe... That's actually an element I like... forget about or don't quite clock, weirdly. Yeah. And maybe that's my own inattention.
Yeah. Imagine from her... Okay, she's a horrible person.
Yeah.
Granted. But imagine you're like, okay, I'm for some reason still unmarried. I'm going to keep my brother's house in this part of the country I don't want to go to. Mm. Like, everything about it is gross to me. I'm leaving London, leaving all my friends, leaving like fashion and stuff, which I love and wear very well. And the only good thing about it is that his friend from school is going to be there the whole time. And we always get on and we always have bitchy fun chats.
Mm.
And we're going to have this whole summer where we have bitchy fun chats and fall in love. And then I'll be the richest woman in the world. And then he's suddenly like, I'm going to hang out with these tacky sisters and actually suddenly decide that us being bitchy and fun isn't funny anymore.
Yeah, that's tough.
That is tough.
That is tough. See, maybe you're just a nicer person than me. I'm just quite like, oh, shut up, get out of the way. Put your boobs away,
Put your boobs
Caroline.
Away, Caroline. I think I just over-relate to anyone called Caroline because they're so frequently given a short shrift by culture.
God, who are the other Carolines?
Calloway, who I'm a great admirer of, as has been committed to this podcast.
I'm an apologist for Caroline Calloway as well.
I would love Caroline Calloway to play a version of Caroline Bingley in a show.
God,
it would be so good.
She would be perfect.
She would be perfect. Anyway. We're running out of time.
Yes.
Is there anything else you want to say about this? We haven't even talked about the hand.
Oh, the hand! The hand is one of my favourite moments in any rom-com, full stop. It is.
Why does it drive women so mad?
Several reasons, I think. Reason number one, basic. Men's hands, very hot. When
large.
You like a man, you love their hands. Like, I saw a tweet recently where someone was like, if a girl tells you she likes your hands, she is doing everything in her power not to fuck you over the top of the table that moment that she says it. So it's that. But it's like, oh, I don't know. It's like he almost can't bear it.
Yeah.
How nice
so
it was to
for people
touch
who can't
hand.
Quite remember.
Oh, yes,
which,
sorry. As
which
if
will
everybody
be no
knows
one,
this.
But recite exactly what happens in the scene.
Okay, so Darcy is putting Jane and Lizzie in the coach to go back home after Jane got stuck with a cold at Netherfield. And he takes Lizzie's hand to put her in the carriage or like help her up, and then turns away, walks back to the house, and it's a close up on his hand, and he just sort of flexes all of it, splays all of his fingers out.
Like he's been like had like an electric shock or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh. But what it's but because why? It's so intimate.
Yeah. It's so clever.
Yeah.
That choice. Because it's like we're dealing with a period where people don't snog and there's no skin.
Yeah.
And I think the way that obviously the BBC version dealt with the kind of lack of bodily physics within these stories, because it is just people, you know, floating little brains on necks wearing shit dresses is like blah, blah, blah. And we flirt through our words. And so you have to return into the sense of the physical and the real. Mm. And the way the BBC version of that was the jump in the lake, where like,
he's so
horny, he must go in the lake.
Yeah.
And that version of that is just the flexing of the hand of like, oh, this is not just a person who's a collection of manners and snobberies and tastes.
They have like desires.
This is a body under these clothes.
Yeah. Oh, it's... I'm slightly speechless thinking about it.
Yeah,
it's so
it's
perfect.
Really good.
I'm trying to think if there are any other important.
Well, there's also there is an ending to this movie that only shows in America.
Yes, have you seen it?
I have, but only on YouTube.
Only
but
on YouTube.
Never in the versions I've watched.
And it's only like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
That they cut off. Okay, so the.
It's almost like an Avengers post-credits sequence.
It almost is. So it's at the end of the British cut, which is what most people will have seen if they saw it in this country, is Mr. Bennett laughing and going, ah, ha, 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 and sort of, you know, being approving of the fact that Lizzie and Darcy are going to get married.
Yeah.
And that's the end.
Yeah, it's just him laughing.
It's just him laughing, which I don't hate. I think that's fine.
No, cute.
Nice. Then there is a 2-minute sequence that was originally in the movie where Darcy and Lizzie are at Pemberley. It's nighttime. There are candles and fires blazing and they're not wearing any shoes and they're like kneeling in front of each other being soppy and they kiss, which is very controversial. So controversial, in fact, that the Jane Austen Society of North America, Mr. Darcy American Cat Girls Club were like, no, like this is, you can't do this. We revolt.
It's so interesting, isn't it? That's something that is so clearly the most, the highest form of like fan fiction and fan service, which is like, you guys have wanted it for 200 years.
Yeah.
Them snogging and saying they love each other.
And they didn't like
it. No, they didn't want it.
Well, maybe they're serious. Maybe they're not Mr. Darcy American Cat Women. Maybe they are serious academics. I've got no idea. But it surprised me. I was like, but surely it's fun for them to have a little snog at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's funny because I don't think it's the fact that he didn't happen in the books is what bothers people. I think if they had invented a different scene, that was more restrained,
it would have been
fine, and people would. But it just feels, I don't know, contrary to Austen's whole sensibility, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean,
but I also don't hate. I don't care.
I don't care. As we both know, we've said we don't care. But if you were minded to care about these sorts of things, I can see why you would care about this particular like deviation from how Austen normally is. It is also a very soppy scene.
It is.
It's a little much, maybe.
It is too much.
It is Keira Knightley at her most. Like, my teeth are in the way of my words and being like, oh, and you're incandescently happy. And it gave me the ick a little bit, because I am so used to the version of the movie without it, probably. Yeah. But yeah, go and look it up.
It does feel a bit like, have you ever seen the, I'm sure you have, the alternate ending of Titanic? Where it's like she drops the necklace, but all the like
and the
fucking
guy,
SWAT
the, like,
team comes out of nowhere.
That like the scientist guy goes, "Hey, lady, that really sucks," which is one of the worst lines I've ever heard.
Hey, lady, that really sucks.
It's so funny. It's so funny. I say that all
the
time.
Hey, lady, that really sucks.
Hey, lady, that really sucks.
Funny.
It's priceless. Well, that's really funny because that ending is garbage, and they were definitely right to change that.
Yeah.
But it's very funny. Yeah, if you've not seen that ending, like, my God, go and look that up, because when that line comes, it's a real like burst out laugh for me.
It's so I completely forgot he said that. I haven't watched it in years. Really, that really sucks. Yeah, you're. I think it is way too saccharine, that ending. But also, again, I don't really care.
Yeah.
And that's the movie.
Yeah, I will. I'll watch it. I'll watch it again this year, probably, and it's mid-November.
I have to say, I did the research for my sort of Pride and Prejudice double bill that we're doing while having COVID. Oh. I can't believe in the year 2023 people are getting COVID and one of them is me.
Yeah.
But it was quite bad. But there's nothing better to watch when you can't go outside than in Austin.
Yeah.
Because it's like just people who are inside all the time.
Yes, that's so true.
You feel so way... You know, when you're on day 4 or 5 being sick and you could technically do stuff, but you still really can't do stuff.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I feel bad about myself for not doing stuff. This is what you put on.
Yeah, it's perfect for like having a little bit of soup.
Oh, my countenance.
Oh.
Yeah.
Such a treat.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, Imogen. You've got a novel out.
I do have a novel out.
Tell us all about it.
It's called Deep Down. It's about a woman who is unmarried. It's not about that. She is unmarried. It is about a pair of siblings who are renegotiating their relationship after their father's death. But it's also funny.
Funny.
Which that doesn't make it sound.
No, as everything you do is. I mean,
Thank you.
I just fell in love with your work. I think at the same time everybody else did, which is when you started doing Bougie Literary Lady.
Yes.
Some of those tweets. So Bougie Literary Lady was like basically Imogen...
Bougie London Literary Woman, please.
Sorry.
The full mouthful, if you please.
Bougie London Literary Woman. She was kind of a take on American Cat Lady.
She's not dissimilar, I was just thinking.
Yeah,
they're definitely friends.
She's a bit more heightened, where she's like, she's obsessed with wild swimming and owning a harp.
She thinks that Mr. Darcy, American Cat Woman, is a little bit naff.
Yes.
But would continue to be friends with her.
Do you think you would be open to starting a new Twitter account that might be...
Mrs. Darcy, American Catwoman. Well, now you've blown it because people will know it's me.
People will know it's you, yeah. Whereas for years, people literally didn't know who Bougie Literary Lady was. Sorry.
Yeah.
London.
Oh, God. What even is... I don't know. Whatever. That thing. No, it was... It
I can't
was
believe you
a
had a secret identity.
I know.
That's so
it was
funny.
So weird and strange. Because also I didn't like... I didn't really have like a career or anything at that point. I was just like some random girl on Twitter.
Just noticing women.
Just looking at people.
And then I remember you had to update the bio being like, by the way, I'm a woman, so this isn't misogynist.
Yeah, I was like, oh God, like I really can't be dealing with that. It's too much. Yeah, wild times.
That was a real... Sorry. If you were a woman and you were on Twitter while Imogen was doing that, it was in a really electric time. It was the golden era of Twitter, and I'm so sad that it's over.
You've got to stop before it gets old, though. I mean, it only went on for like 4 months. It was a very short-lived...
When the fun stops, stop.
In and out.
Anyway, thank you so much, Imogen.
Thank you for having me.